I thought the entrance, one side of the house was supposed to be informal, so I thought it should be on there, should be on the blackboard. It also means it will not be recorded for posterity.
Wait, 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 you can't get away, you have to wear the mic.
Oh, okay. The words without the numbers.
The words without the numbers, exactly.
What's coming in on the TV screen, is it Zwicky?
Huh?
Zwicky?
Zwicky, right.
Is it live?
Okay, it didn't work. Experiment failed.
I'm in S-ray binaries and low mass binary pulsars or, you know, essentially binary pulsars or pulsars are all sort of equivalent. So traditionally, the low mass X-ray binaries are distinguished from the high mass X-ray binaries or X-ray pulsars by the fact that the companions are substantially less luminous than the X-ray source in the optical. So the high mass X-ray binaries, usually it's a B or O star companion. The low mass X-ray binaries is usually a K or M dwarf, although in a couple of cases, which are quite interesting, we'll talk about their more massive systems or descendants of more massive systems. Of course, these pulsars, the millisecond binary pulsars with population with pulsar spin periods in the range of 1.5 to 100 milliseconds or so, in only one of these cases do we definitively know a coherent spin period, which is 2.5 milliseconds, which is wonderful because that's just like a millisecond pulsar. And those of you that were present in the beginning of the conference know that there are a number of other cases where there's evidence for during bursts for also similar spin frequencies of 300 or possibly 600 hertz. So there's a little bit of a direct connection in that sense. Another property of these systems is that the absence of strong X-ray pulses tells you that the magnetic field is probably relatively low, and these systems also have at least a dipole component in the magnetic field, 10 to the 8 to 10 to 10 gauss. So in the pulsar world, let me just show one of these traditional BEP diagrams. Let's see, is it possible to get this light off the place? So this shows all of the currently known millisecond pulsars minus 6, which are confidential, so I was not allowed to show them to you. So the ones to look at are these ones in magenta. The ones with white dots are systems where the pulsar has an optically identified white dwarf companion. And these ones with stars are binary pulsars, which are analogs of the high mass X-ray binaries. They have, in two cases, 10 solar mass B stars, and in one case, 10 or 12 solar mass K giant companion observed orbiting the pulsar. So the first thing to notice is that, except for these high mass systems and the ones with perhaps double neutron star systems, most of these have quite low magnetic fields, most of them piled up around 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 gauss. The spin down ages are typically more than a giga-year, some more than 10 to 10 years. And the cooling ages are also, from the white dwarfs, are also of order several giga years, 10 to the 10 years, confirming that the P over P dot age is not wildly wrong.
If we take seriously the ones with high field, they're not going to live very long as radio pulsars. Is there a big, no, higher, the highest white dots?
Mm-hmm.
Is the birth rate for those bigger than the birth rate for millisecond pulsars if you assume that they will turn off after a million years?
These are typically the lifetimes here are like 10 to the 8th year. So this system what we used to be thought as 2303, which used to be thought to be double neutron star system, both McCarney and McCarrick, I think they detected a white dwarf in their system, highly eccentric. So this is an unusual system in that the white dwarf must have been the first born of the neutron star, the second born. But the birth rate for these systems, in fact, is not, these, both of these systems are quite distant, so if you do the birth rate analysis, in fact, it ends up being dominated by these. And nearest one of these is less than 100 parsecs away, and these are kiloparsecs. But I'll talk about the division of birth rates among these various types of systems.
And so you're going to talk about the green, the M dot N equilibrium line?
Okay.
Has it been moving around?
It's been moving around. Well, this is a theoretical line.
I understand.
Okay. My interpretation is that this line probably has very little to do with the birth of millisecond pulsars, but I'll excited to say a little more about that. Another point is, you notice that there's this line I've drawn here, the death line, and some of you may know that this death line is the one which I computed 10 years ago, and here are the three pulsars.
Sure.
Oh, so that's not quite over. This line, of course, many people draw just the straight death line, but they usually forget that there is a line running along this direction. And on this side, the pulsar is able to accelerate particles to the full energy of the gap. On this side of the line, it's limited by the acceleration of particles is limited by radiation reaction. And so the usual death line has been computed assuming the particles get to the full potential gap. If you allow for the fact that there's a radiation reaction limit, the analogous death line changes slope where these two lines intersect. And this is the appropriate death line for millisecond pulsars. Again, assuming just photon magnetic particle creation, photon-photon particle creation from a heated polar cap and inverse Compton and so on can move this around a little bit. But I think one point to notice is that these pulsars are piled up against this death line for millisecond pulsars, and so it's not inconceivable that there could be a large population with lower magnetic fields if birth rates allow it. And certainly the birth rates are uncertain to factors of four or so, so there could easily be four times more pulsars than 10 to the 7, 10 to the 7, or 10 to the 4 times more neutron stars, which would not be detectable with radio pulsars with 10 to the 7 Gauss fields, and we would never know about them.
But this does provide independent evidence that these guys are spinning down by dipole radiation, not some gravitational radiation.
I'm not sure the spin down, but this is to do with the emission mechanism, not right. The spin down.
Your plotting is as an investment P dot, right? So.
Yeah, I mean the. So I guess the two arguments perhaps against gravitational radiation or some other exotic mechanism is, first of all, the point dwarf cooling ages are consistent within a factor of two with the spin down ages, which you wouldn't expect the spin down age if the P dot had a time behavior which was very different than the usual dipole. I guess the other argument here is that this interpretation, depending on where you think the emission comes from, this is telling you something about the field that has about a dipole strength in the region where the particles are coming from, rather than something much stronger or much weaker that is dipole components. Now, unfortunately, I have to tell you a little bit about stellar evolution in binary stars, so I'll try to keep it very simple. So the first thing to remember about stars is that they're low-mass stars, and I'll call them intermediate. With a dividing line around 2.2 solar masses, so low mass all defined as below 2.2, and intermediate mass above 2.2. And below this mass, as the star evolves off the main sequence and exhausts hydrogen in its center, helium ignites degenerately. Heavier stars have lower densities and somewhat higher temperatures, and they can ignite helium non-degenerately. The consequence of this is the star has a helium flash and becomes a red giant. And it moves very rapidly from a radius which is approximately at 0 8 main sequence radius to a radius which is about 10 times larger on a thermal time scale for thermal readjustment radiation leakage from the star. The heavier stars do not have such a sudden change in radius. They just gradually go from hydrogen burning to helium burning, and there's one gap, no sudden change in radius by a factor of about 10.
Was a red giant, and then it falls to the horizontal branch. I mean, is that what you? And that's the discontinuous change.
No. This is the Hertzsprung gap. This is the evolution from. I should distinguish two things.
Yeah.
So there's a sudden increase in radius on the thermal. So here. The star, as it exhausts hydrogen in the center, is building up helium and starting to burn hydrogen in a thin shell. It increases in radius, and then when the helium ignites, there is a sudden change in the radius of the star, and it begins burning helium plus continuing hydrogen burning in a thin shell. Whereas here, there's for the heavier stars, there's no such sudden transition. One consequence of the sudden change in radius and the fact that the central core is degenerate, burning in a thin shell, is that. As the star is burnt, begins to burn, the luminosity is mostly being generated in a thin shell, whose properties are almost independent of the surrounding envelope. And that means that the luminosity of the star and its radius, since it's nearly fully convective, depend just almost exclusively on the mass of the helium core as the star is evolving up the red giant branch. And it depends very little on the mass of the surrounding envelope. So that's the core mass radius and core mass luminosity relationships. For the heavier stars, there is no such relationship. The mass of the burning is not in a thin shell, and the whole mass of the star actually matters. Let's now consider, suppose that we've managed to make, through the evolution of a very massive star and an intermediate or low mass star, suppose that we managed through cleverly arranged kick velocities and initial orbital periods to make a system which consists of a neutron star orbited by an ordinary main sequence star of mass, say, less than 5 solar masses. Now, let's consider the first case when this is a low mass, so less than about 2 solar masses. Depending on the initial orbital period, perhaps after circularization of the orbit as the star begins to swell, um, if the initial orbital period is, let's say, is long enough that the initial separation is more than about 10 zero H main sequence radii, this star will not begin to fill its Rossellou until it's evolved and begun thin shell burning. It's actually become a red giant. So that typically happens if the initial orbital period is greater than about 30 days. So then this star will evolve as if it was an isolated star until it becomes a thin shell burning star and begins to transfer mass onto the neutron star. Now, when that happens, you have to ask, is this transfer stable or not? So you have to look at the stability of the mass transfer. Now, the simplest case to think about is, suppose this star is much less massive than the neutron star. Actually, the most massive stars that you've all the red giants in the Hubble time are not that much less massive than the neutron star, but let's suppose that it is very much less, if we look that way. Then, if I transfer mass to this star, conserving mass and angular momentum, just the old-fashioned way to do things, conserving mass, you can imagine, seems quite reasonable. Therefore, I move material from the L1 point between onto the neutron star, and there's no reason for mass to conserve mass. Conserving angular momentum is maybe a little bit less obvious, because you know that the accretion disk is transporting angular momentum outwards. The question is, where does it go? If you assume that the accretion disk expands until tidal torques between the accretion disk and the star are able to transfer the angular momentum of the material which is accreted to the neutron star through the accretion disk and then through tides back into this star, then you can conserve both energy and both mass and angular momentum. Now, just as in the solar system, most of the angular momentum is in Jupiter, not the Sun. It's usually almost always the case that most of the angular momentum is in this orbiting low-mass body rather than the rotation of this neutron star, which is small, or even that it's the spin of this star. So if you imagine losing material from Jupiter onto the Sun, conserving mass and angular momentum, the addition of mass to the mass of Jupiter's mass to the Sun does not change its mass significantly, but the angular momentum, which is the mass of Jupiter, or GM Sun, on A, if the mass of Jupiter is decreasing, then to conserve angular momentum, the semi major axis must increase, so the orbit must expand. The newer way to do things is not to bother with this conserving mass and angular momentum. And I've argued for a long time that that must be the case, because if you look at most of these systems that form low-mass binary pulsars, the amount of mass that's been accreted onto the neutron star is 1, 2, 3 solar masses, and that becomes an embarrassment if you really believe that you put all the mass that was initially in the envelope to the star ended up on the neutron star, would otherwise be a black hole.
How do you know it's more than 3 solar masses?
Well, in the most typical system, the final state is a 0.2 solar mass white dwarf. The initial star must have been at least 1 solar masses, and in many cases, since it's carbon-oxygen white dwarf, you know it must have been 3 or 4 solar masses. And we think an ordinary looking neutron star in some cases with major masses 1.4. So there's not room to accrete 0.8 or 2 or 3 solar masses onto it. So it's clear that a lot of the mass must have been lost. Now the question is, where was it lost from? And here it starts to matter for the evolution. What I think probably happens is the material is lost from the systems. It starts to go in through the accretion disk, but you can easily convince yourself that if you have some M dot being transferred, and you have an M dot accretion actually onto the surface of the neutron star, that I only need to on energetic grounds at least, I only need to accrete an amount of material, which is the outer radius of the disk. R neutron star over R is times m dot transfer. The gravitational potential is much deeper here than at the edge of the disk, so I can blow off at the outer edge of the disk almost all of m dot transfer by accreting a tiny fraction down to the much deeper gravitational potential well. Now you can put in some fudge factor here for the efficiency of the transfer and all of that, but this is a large number, like 10 to the 5, and so it's not particularly in the case of these transfer rates, as we'll see, you're often super-editing them. It's not unreasonable to imagine that most of the material is run off. So if this happens, so the material begins to go in the accretion disk that is ejected by radiation pressure from the neutron star or by the magnetically dominated wind or whatever your favorite ejection mechanism is. This actually looks very much like this. You're not conserving mass, but you are sort of conserving angular momentum in the sense that the material probably shrinks in a factor of a few in radius, so it's must have transferred most of its angular momentum back. If that happens, it turns out that the stability criteria are slightly different than in this case, but not very different. Soberman and Hoyle and I worked those out several years ago. And you can easily convince yourself that the reason it doesn't matter very much is if the mass of, if you're conserving the angular momentum and the mass of Jupiter is going down, it doesn't matter very much whether you put it on the sun or not. So in this extreme limit, it makes no difference. As the mass ratio becomes close to 1, it makes a slight difference in the change in the stability. Okay, so now let's look at the other extreme. Suppose this star is much heavier than this one. Now this one is the one from which the angular momentum, most of the angular momentum is now in the neutron star. Okay, so I know, so this is in the, so this is the star much less than mass of the neutron star. And here is mass of the star much greater than mass of the neutron star. Now this is the total angular momentum. Now if I reduce the mass so in the conservative case, if I transfer material from this star to the neutron star, if I conserve angular momentum, then the mass of the neutron star is increasing. This one is at least initially not changing very much because it's a much more massive one. And so the semi-major axis must drop extremely rapidly. The orbit must shrink very rapidly. If you're not doing conservative transfer, if you're blowing most of the material off, then the mass of the neutron star remains almost fixed. This doesn't change very much, and the semi-major axis doesn't change very much. So obviously in this limit, it makes a substantial difference that the orbit either conservative or that shrinks, non-conservative, approximately fixed in size. Okay. So the first sort of interesting case to look at then is the case of the low mass stars when we see that the orbit is expanding. And this star, as it evolves, if it's the initial orbital period is fairly long, it's a red giant star. The core grows, the luminosity and the radius of light increase, and so the star begins to overflow its rock flow. But as it does so, it loses material. And you can show that it stably transfers its envelope each time it exchanges a little bit of mass. The radius of the star increases a little bit because it's a fully convective star, but the orbit expands even more, and so that it has to wait until the star continues its nuclear evolution in order to refill the rock flow. So in the low mass case, like a stapled transfer on the nuclear timescale. And that continues until the whole envelope has been transferred, and I'm just left with the core, which will be a helium white dwarf. Now, because of this core mass radius relationship, I essentially transfer until the mass of the envelope becomes so low that its radius and it shrinks down onto the white dwarf, typically a few thousandths of the solar mass. And when that happens, the radius of the Rush lobe, which is the radius of the star, is then determined by the core, the mass of the final white dwarf. And that means that the orbital period of the final system will be determined by the core mass. So there is a unique white dwarf mass orbital period relation, which is predicted for all of these low mass systems. So, I hope this will convince you of the need for thinking about high mass systems. Okay, so this beautiful line plus some of these, which sort of illustrate what happens as you go from 0.9 to 1.75 solar masses, is the predicted core mass radius relationship. And it depends a little bit on metallicity. You can go from population 2 to population 1 abundance as it moves. It moves a little bit. It depends on the mixing length using for the red giant, which determines the radii of the red giants, obviously. But there's perhaps a band, something like this, which is sort of allowing all the uncertainties and the ranges of metallicities, which could be appropriate. And these bands show the 90% confidence intervals of the masses of the white dwarf companions to the pulsars with white dwarf companions. In most cases, all we know is the mass function. So if you assume, so what's been done here is to assume that the neutron star has a mass of 1.4 solar masses, which doesn't matter very much, and then plot the most probable mass, the 60 degree inclination, the minimum mass, and the 95% probability inclination for its nearly phase-on mass. In a few cases, when I can find one here, 1855 here, we actually have much better limits on the mass from relativistic effects in the pulsar timing, which directly point to the Shapiro delay, which directly tell you this, the mass of the neutron star to a much better precision. Now, the ones which are known with good precision actually lie remarkably close to this line, but the ones that are known with poor precision, you notice that this long period end, which is the range where the discussion I just told you really should work best, so it really began transfer a while with the red giant through the whole phase. The masses are definitely in the helium white dwarf range. You notice there seems to be quite a systematic trend for the masses to be the most probable masses to be down here, which would require that almost all of these systems be observed nearly full on in order to get the masses up here. So you can think about selection effects. The spin axis has been aligned with the magnetic axis. The spin axis has been aligned with the orbital axis through the mass transfer, and therefore if the magnetic axis and the pulsar beam are nearly aligned, perhaps you could arrange to it all when they see the systems if they were full on. But there are a couple of cases where it actually has independent constraints on the inclination to what the dwarf is actually seen, and that doesn't look so good in those cases. The other cases which obviously speak out here is the maximum mass of the core, which can ignite helium non-degenerately, is about 0.45 solar masses. So all of these systems over here, these six systems, perhaps a couple more, must be carbon oxygen white dwarfs. Can't make a helium white dwarf. With that mass, will just ignite. So we obviously have to consider the evolution of more massive systems. The other point to notice is there's a substantial population with orbital periods less than 2 days. And if you think about the evolution of those must have either, if they were, if you try to make them through this scenario, they would have initially been in contact on the main sequence, the neutron star, the companion star. So we obviously have to sort of think a little bit more carefully about what happens down in its low period end and see if we can understand what happens with more massive stars. So, for the more massive stars, is that if you ask about the connection to the X-ray binaries, one has to beware of a very severe selection effect. And that is that as you look at this, the transfer during this phase of stable nuclear-driven transfer, the rate of increase of radius of the star depends, is determined by the rate of burning nuclear fuel. Since the core mass is increased, the rate of increase of the core mass is just determined by the luminosity divided by 0.08 c squared. So the systems with longer orbital periods are burning much more rapidly and therefore increasing the radii much more rapidly and therefore have much higher m dots. So the systems with long initial orbital periods have much higher mass accretion rates. There's another effect, which is that if you ask about this, there's a universal core mass radius relationship, but let's consider the difference between, say, a 1 solar mass star and a 1.6 solar mass star initially. And you can ask, for a 1 solar mass star, what is the, with an initial orbital period of 10 days, what is the X-ray lifetime, and what is it for a 1.6 solar mass star. So let me cover up most of this diagram. So this shows white dwarf mass versus final orbital period, and this is the core mass period relationship, which I referred to and just showed you on the color plot for low mass systems. The rest of this diagram is showing what happens to higher mass systems. But I've just illustrated here for a system with initial mass of 1 solar mass, about the minimum that can evolve in this way in the Hubble time, and 1.6 solar mass is the X-ray lifetimes. So here is 10 to the 9 years, and here is 10 to the 8 years. And if I look at the longer orbital periods, it's 10 to the 7 years for the 1 solar mass, and only 7 million years for the 1.6 solar mass system. So if you ask about, say, an initial mass function, this isn't really an initial mass function, this is a survival function given the fact that the neutron star had to have exploded and remained in the binary. Even the initial mass function, there's only about a 2-to-1 difference in the numbers of these types of systems versus these, to include the fact that it has to survive the supernova explosion. In fact, it's probably more nearly 1-to-1 in the ratio of the numbers of systems. Numbers of millisecond pulsars you expect to have been born in this way versus this way. But you'll notice that then when you look at X-ray, an X-ray selected sample, you can see all of the systems in the galaxy. These are all, say, a tenth of Eddington or brighter. The numbers of systems that you'll see will be completely dominated by these low mass systems of the short orbital periods. So we know about 100 X-ray binaries in the galaxy. So we predict to see essentially none of these kinds of systems, even though the total number of flux may be comparable to these. We'll see a few of the higher mass systems, and most of them will be dominated by low mass, one solar mass companions in very short orbital periods, a few few days. This is the final statement, of course, the rate of evolution along here increases very rapidly, so light pine down here is even several better than 9 years. So there's a prediction that when you look at the X-ray sample, you're getting a very different view of the population than when you look at the pulsar population. Because the pulsar population will be dominated just by the total numbers of end states and perhaps the final magnetic field of pulsar, but we saw that most of them seem to have ages and lifetimes of 10 to 15 years. But the X-ray binaries will be dominated by these low-mass, short-period systems. So one should bear that in mind when trying to compare the samples and birth rates, is that in the X-ray sample, we don't even expect to have any of these systems, even though it could be observed to be about half of all the pulsar systems.
But also the selection factor, the fact that those systems as accretors tend to be transients rather than steady. So there's also a selection factor that the occurrence time is like 10,000 years or 500 years.
Yeah.
And we're stuck.
Yeah, so I guess the one sort of way of looking at the observational selection, I think the longest orbital period known for low mass X-ray binary is 5.6 days. Whereas you notice that about half of the pulsars are longer than that. Okay, so Lars asked about the eccentricity period relationship. So the only theory I know for that is my own, so I will describe it. For these low mass systems undergoing single transfer as a red giant, we can show that if the orbit is initially a little bit eccentric, it will induce a time dependent tide in the red giant star. And the time scale to circularize the orbit due to eddy viscosity damping this dynamical tide is of order 10 to the 40 years typically. And the eccentricity will then decrease proportional to e to the minus t over tau, where this is like 10 to the 4 years. We saw that the light times were 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 years, so the eccentricity should be zero to infinitely many significant figures, or at least several hundred significant figures. However, the eccentricities of these systems are observed to be numbers like 10 to the minus 4 plus or minus 1. They are not e to the minus 11 or e to the minus 10 to the 4. So the reason that I argue that the only sort of story which seems to me to make sense for that is the following, that this red giant is convective, and therefore there are blobs of hot low-density material rising and cold high-density material falling, and those produce a time-dependent external potential. An external butterfall moment, because the star is not perfectly spherical, but has expand the surface potential and the exterior potential in spherical harmonics, and the convection produces time-dependent external multifolds. And you can show, for example, the sort of nice little theorem that one can prove is that if you had this star which just had a thin shell with one size of convective eddy in it, then there is an equilibrium in which the epicyclic energy of the eccentric orbit, m over 2a times e squared, so that's the epicyclic energy, is equal to the kinetic energy of one eddy. So the way to think of that is to think of a pendulum in air. You know that if the pendulum is swinging in air on a frictionless pivot and all of that, that there will be a drag force rho v squared due to the air, which will stop the pendulum. And it will stop on some characteristic time scale, and its amplitude will be zero. Then, of course, you know that if you look microscopically, there are individual little air molecules hitting the pendulum, so it was absolutely at rest. You expect the final state to be an energy where it would be a case where the kinetic energy kinetic potential energy is 1.5 kT per degree of freedom. So you can show here that there's an exactly analogous effect, but these time-dependent external multipoles make the eccentricity random walk up by exerting small torques on the neutron star. But if the eccentricity becomes too large, then this macroscopic damping causes it to decay. If you write down the Fokker-Planck equation, it looks very much like the Fokker-Planck equation for the pendulum, then there's an equilibrium. Now, for real red giant stars, unfortunately, there are many sizes of convective eddies on all scales inside the star, so you have to integrate over all of their effects and the potential and then the damping. And the result is that you can predict an RMS eccentricity, and you can also predict the distribution, just as you know that not all pendula will have kinetic energies exactly equal to 1.5 kT, that there will be a distribution that you can work out. Likewise, here, solving the Fokker-Planck equation in probability space, there's a distribution you can work out. And I worked that out using simple Polyi models for the stellar evolution at a time when there was this pulsar, and this pulsar. Okay, and these lines haven't changed since then. Okay, the point dots are the pulsars, which are close enough to the core mass period relationship that they ought to have, they could have been consistent with this low mass evolution, which I described. The point things are up, the eccentricity is still only an upper limit, so wherever you want in the vertical diagram. And these red circles are the systems where the point dwarf is clearly a carbon-oxygen point dwarf, and this whole scenario is completely irrelevant. So you should not ignore the red. So the red circles will have a different theory, which I can talk about. So it's going from 3 to a little over a dozen, and they all still seem to work fairly well. You might be a little bit concerned about having three systems at 2 sigma. But the other thing to notice is that this line has curvature in it, and I should explain why there's curvature in it. There's curvature in it because at the very short orbital periods, the orbital frequency is higher than all of the convective eddy time scales in the red giant. So, you have to decide what happens when you have a time which is very rapid and you're trying to damp it by slow motion. This problem arises also in the theory of excitation of oscillations of the sun and other stars. And Goldreich and Keeley argued that the correct thing to do was to say that slow eddies have essentially exponentially small effect on rapid tides or rapid oscillations. So what you have to do is look at the power in the Kolmogorov cascade, which has higher frequencies in it. So although the bulk eddy is very slow, there will always be some sufficiently short length scale, a little bit of power in fast eddies, which can resonate with the time, and those will dominate the effect. So that's what's been assumed here, and the reason there's curvature in these lines is because at this orbital, below these orbital periods, that effect starts to be important, and I've assumed that there's no damping to the other eddies. Now, Jean-Paul Jean has argued, and the embarrassments of the problem of trying to circularize main sequence stars with 12-day orbital periods and open clusters is perhaps empirical evidence that something else might be going on, although there are other stories. If you neglected that effect, you could just draw a straight line here, and there are several other prescriptions which have been proposed. That makes it makes this point a little bit more comfortable, but doesn't have much effect on these two.
Stroke, if I understand this, the range of eccentricity is about a factor of 1,000. So the range of E squared is about a factor of 1,000,000.
That's right.
And in your relation between the epicyclic kinetic energy and the kinetic energy of the one
convective plume. There is a relation, I mean, basically E squared times the mass of the companion divided by A is.
Right, so the range, okay, so the way to think of it, so there's a range of about a million in the eccentricities.
But only by the fact of 108.
So you're asking for an order of magnitude derivation, is that?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a m e squared over a is what you're saying to be drawn to solar masses in space. And then on the other side is the kinetic energy of an eddy. Okay, and kinetic energy of an eddy on the scale of the radius of the star is going to be something like rho v squared on r cubed. But rho v cubed is L over R squared.
I was just concerned that there's a very wide range of E squared, and yet there seems to be a relatively small range of M and A. And
why are you concerned with that? I'm sorry, what's the concern?
Well, how you can satisfy that relation by having...
Well, but the luminosity of a star, at this orbital period, the luminosity of the star filling the Rossi globe here is 10 to the minus 4 of the luminosity of the star that filled this Rossi globe. And the density is a factor of a million lower, and so V is a factor of 10 to the 4, and squared is 10 to the 8, right? So these red giants up here have essentially supersonic turbulence, or almost supersonic turbulence, and the star down here is like the sun, right? And
these
stars down here
are not fully
convective,
so it's so forth. Yeah. So the objects at 100 days, where there's sort of a vertical line there, are those the ones that on the previous plot were on the previous orbital period? Are those the ones that were always sort of to the left of the line?
I see what I'm asking. Okay,
those guys, I guess.
Yeah, so it's essentially this block.
Two above, one below.
Yeah, I mean, of course, if this is all just an inclination effect, then there's no issue with there's something else systematic going on. That would be an issue.
What's the point is the Q that we're assuming for the resonant or matching or mismatching between the frequency being the star and the orbit frequency? In other words, to have a good exchange, energy exchange.
You integrate over the spectrum of eddies in the star, right? So effectively, it actually doesn't matter because what you do is you assume that there's a spectrum of eddies, and I've just actually used the delta function approximation. I assume that only the eddies that are in resonance matter, but the spectrum of eddies is so broad that Q doesn't actually matter, right? Delta function approximation.
Well, I mean, assuming it's a parallel where the exponent is of order unity.
Well,
the resonance.
There's a damping time scale, which is effectively what determines the cube. So I've just used the delta function approximation, but the coupling coefficient is determined by the damping time.
The question which was asked, I guess partly out of curiosity, is if you know what the cube is.
Well, the damping time scale is of order 10 to the 4 years, and the orbital time scales are 100 days, so it's quite high.
Okay.
Excuse me. So you say that in order to not have a damping afterwards, you need that the stars stop being red giant on a time scale shorter than 10 to 4 years.
No.
How does it work?
Okay. This is a subtlety which has been glossed over in the discussion, but not in the calculations. Okay. So let's consider we have a pendulum. Let's do the pendulum analogy first. Suppose we have a pendulum swinging in air. Keep the temperature constant, and we gradually pump the air out. as we pump the air out, the damping time scale for the pendulum is going to increase to infinity. And eventually, if we're pumping it out on some time scale, the time scale for damp will become longer than the time scale on which we're pumping it out, and it'll effectively have the pendulum swinging in vacuum. And the amplitude will have been determined by the temperature at that freeze-out point, when it started acting as if it was effectively vacuum, the density of air was dropping. So what happens here is, you're right, while it's a red giant in the neck of it, in filling its raw slope, there is an equilibrium eccentricity and some distribution about that. And what will be seen in the final pulsar is, as the envelope is transferred, eventually the envelope gets to such a low mass that it starts to become optically thin and shrink down onto the companion. But the tidal coupling goes proportional to r to the 8. So as the star begins to shrink, when it's shrunk by a factor of 2 in radius, this time scale is increased by a factor of 256, and shrunk by a factor of 3 is completely decoupled. So what actually goes into this calculation is not the eccentricity computer for a red giant with a 0.5 solar mass envelope, but it's the red giant whose envelope is shrunk to about half of the initial radius, so that the time scale for this time scale is actually increased up to a border time scale on which the radius of the envelope is shrinking the time scale. So it's a little bit of a tricky calculation in the sense that you actually sort of need to know the opacities of low density envelopes in those late stages to determine those diagrams.
It sounds like an incredibly tricky calculation, and yet you got the curve right.
It's incredibly tricky, but remember this, you know, there's this R to the 8 factor, so you're actually taking the 1H power of the observables.
Oh, so, I see, it works the other way around.
Yeah. Okay. So although you might worry that you've gotten things wrong by a factor of 10, it's usually 10 to the 1/6 power, 10 to the 1/8 power that comes into those.
Okay.
So. Okay. Let's see. Gosh.
Already. How are you doing?
I haven't gotten to the high mass systems at all yet. maybe I'll just spend 10 minutes on the high mass systems. So the interest in the high mass systems comes from asking, what about all of those systems where the initial stellar mass was not less than 2 solar masses, and the initial transfer could have been unstable? And alternatively, how do we make all of these systems, there could be something else going on for some population, some proportion of these. Now, the traditional story for the high mass systems. Is that in order to make a carbon oxygen point dwarf, you must have an initial orbit. Which is, so you must start, first of all, with a fairly massive star, more massive than about 2 solar masses, so that you make the carbon oxygen wet dwarf at all. Since that is then more massive than the neutron star, when it filled its Roche lobe, it would be unstable transfer. If it came into contact before you had made carbon oxygen white dwarf, you would have unstable transfer, which would shrink the system, remove the envelope, and you would never be able to make the carbon oxygen white dwarf because you would remove all of the material.
What exactly would happen there?
Suppose I have a 3 solar mass star, yeah. 3 solar mass star, and the 1.4 solar mass neutron star in a 10-day orbital period, say, like one of the ones that we're applying for low mass system. Then, as this star begins to evolve, the traditional story goes, when this system fills its Roche lobe, I have unstable transfer. The neutron star spirals into this system, ejects the envelope, and if this initial orbital period is 10 days, that happens when this system doesn't even have a segregated core at all. So I'd probably make a Thorne-Chief co-object, for example, and neutron star sitting in the bottom of that system.
Or you make a close neutron star white.
Well, no, but there's no, see, these systems don't ignite helium non-degenerately. There's no sharp distinction between the core and the envelope. So you can't, in the Earth, the envelope isn't very extended, so you don't actually have, you never, there's no radius in the star when you have enough energy to unbind the envelope and leave behind the core. It just sinks. So that's the traditional argument. These Mapthorne jigsaw objects are perhaps, by some miracle, you can eject all the material and make an isolated neutron star or something. You don't make a binary one more neutron star system. So the traditional story is that in order to make that system, what you need to do is to start off with an initial separation such that this rush radius for this star is about 100 stellar radii, initial orbital period of about 1,000 days. And then the star evolves, goes through helium burning, finishes helium burning, and only at that point, just at the very tip of the giant, at the asymptotic giant branch for this system, does the star become large enough to fill the rush lobe, send unstable transfer, and at that point I actually have a carbon-oxygen point war, essentially already sitting down here in the center of this red giant. I have unstable transfer, so this system spirals in. I have a very extended system, so it's easy to unbind the envelope. I spiral in, and I'm left with a neutron star orbiting a carbon-oxygen point war. So in that scenario, there's absolutely no reason why the eccentricities of these systems should have anything whatever to do with the story of the program, because these systems would have been made by direct spiraling, ejecting the envelope. There's no stable transfer, no red giant in equilibrium, nothing like that. This is all happening. These are made in 10 years or something.
I would expect that the eccentricity scenario you just told would be extremely small.
Well, remember the spiraling time scale is 10 orbits, so you might imagine that the pitch angle of the spiral is 10 degrees, and perhaps the eccentricity could be 10%.
Okay.
I don't know how to calculate it.
Yeah, you don't have a theory for this, for these eccentricities, I take.
For that scenario, for these systems.
Ah.
So I kept saying this is the old traditional story, so let me tell you about the new non-traditional story. Okay. The new non-traditional story.
Yeah, what's wrong with that story? Before you get a new one.
It's old.
You can't predict the orbital periods. The problem is if you work.
Because you have no idea when you went behind the envelope, so you have no idea how close.
Well, the problem is that you'll notice that five of these systems all have orbital periods about 10 days. One of those would be okay. The problem is there seems to be that this population, there are six of them, and five of them are about 10 days. If you notice just sort of a bit of fine-tuning, but you have to have your initial orbit big enough so that just at the end of transfer you begin to shrink. If you do a population synthesis with a regional range of initial masses and center major axes, you'll remember that the final radius after spiraling is determined by the fact that the binding energy of the final binary must be enough to eject the binding energy of the envelope. And the final separations are quite sensitive to the binding energy of the envelope, which in turn depends on the initial separation and the mass of the companion star. And essentially, in the population synthesis, you sort of produce a smear from 0.5 to 100 days. And it's very hard to see what would be special about 15 days in that kind of scenario. This is a spiral that is just so sensitive.
Can't you say that's when you have enough energy to go?
Well, for a particular separation and a particular mass, like 2.3 solar masses in 1,012 days, yes, I can produce that. And the problem is that if I change it to three solar masses in 1,200 days, then I can produce a very different final period.
But this, shouldn't there be sort of a garden variety envelope?
Well, we know the stars have 2, 3, 4, or 5 solar masses, and they have a logarithmic distribution of initial separations, so it's equally probable to have every log of initial separation.
The problem is when it fills its rush
load. It's the point when it fills its rush
load,
right?
So it's the orbital period matters. Yeah, okay, so you can't get them. Yeah. All right.
So that's...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, for the Luma 6, we manage, for the Luma 6 objects. In this case, you may have those that for very long of the view, you may have a detachment of the neutron star. Because when you reach a centricity nearby one, you may also have that after such some conditions, you can have that the edges will be strong enough to produce a detachment of the neutron stars or not?
No. The eccentricities are.
I mean, if you want to get an eccentricity of order one, that means that you
can. But these eccentricities are 10 to the minus 3.
You can reach 10 to the minus 1 or so.
Well, no. This system at 1200 days, which is about the longest you could have and never come into contact with the stars.
The fact that you don't see objects beyond that is not just because they have been detached, right?
Yeah, well, essentially, there's no, beyond about 2000 days, there's no type of star which becomes large enough to fill its rush load in that orbital period. And so any such systems would just have the main sequence star, neutron star binaries. So such systems probably should exist. The only trouble is that such wide systems, of course, it's very improbable to make them because the orbital velocity is so tiny compared to the pulsar kick velocity that it's hard to see how the really wide binary would make that. Okay, so let me now tell you about what happens with the higher mass system. Let's start with this one. Okay. So the story I just told you about the low mass systems is over here. So this shows sort of initial, these are systems which make in white, or it's the region of parameter space which leads to neutron stars orbiting white dwarfs. The traditional story I just told you for making the carbon oxygen white dwarfs is sort of using a little band up here, carbon oxygen point dwarf region when the orbital period is long enough that the spiral may be tuned just enough to make the final system. But there's another one thing here which has been pointed out by several people. This is a paper by Torres and Salomon, who've done some of the analysis calculations, most detailed, going into parameter space with these sorts of things. And that's this range you notice of initial orbital periods of a few days in masses between 2 and about 4 solar masses. And you can ask, what's special about this region? Well, in order to make this region of parameter space interesting, you need to have two things. One is you have to believe the story I told you about non-conservative transfer. Not every bit of mass ends up on the neutron star. That's obviously crucial, otherwise these would all be black hole white dwarf systems. It's also crucial, actually, for the orbital evolution of the city. And the second point is that these systems are separation. When they fill the launch load, they're essentially just a little bit off the main sequence. So these stars are still fully radiated throughout the whole envelope. So although these stars were always convective when they were filling the launch load, so when you remove a little bit of mass, the star expands a little bit. For the radiative envelope, when you remove a little bit of mass, the star shrinks. So you remember I told you that if you had a very massive star, if you have conservative transfer, the orbit shrinks very rapidly, and this radiative envelope can't save you. But if you have non-conservative transfer, so you eject most of the material, the orbital separation doesn't change very much. So the fact that this star is radiative means that when you transfer some of the mass onto the neutron star, the star shrinks. The orbit separation is almost fixed, so this is actually stable transfer on a thermal time scale now. So it's not occurring on a nuclear time scale, it's occurring on a thermal time scale. And the thermal time scales for these stars are typically from 10 to the 5 years or so for these really massive stars. So the mass transfer rates are about 10 to the 4 times Eddington. They're very large transfer rates, but if you can eject most of the material, that's not a problem.
the minus four solar masts per year if...
On the new front, sorry, for 2,000 years.
But generated by the companion stars and building to expand?
Well...
Is that like the Kelvin Helmholtz time?
Yeah, it's the Kelvin time scale for the sun. Yeah, this is transfer on the thermal time scale. So you remove material, and on an adiabatic time scale, the star shrinks, but then on the thermal time scale, it's trying to re-expand. So you're driving the transfer on the thermal time scale.
But then, if we're driving well on that matter, you have to have a really powerful, at least an energy. Minus four solar mass per year is really bright, I mean.
That's right, but remember, the neutron star, if you're accreting that material, if you're blowing that material off at the outer edge of the accretion disk, you only have to accrete 10 to the minus 8 solar masses a year on the neutron star to produce enough energy to drive off 10 to the minus 4 solar masses a year. So at least on energetic grounds, you can't really have these other people out.
If you accrete 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year for only a few thousand years, and you accrete a very small mass, presumably it cannot produce large spins. What kind of spin?
I just got to get through this thermal time scale. Now you have to ask what happens after that. Okay, we haven't got there yet. So I've got it. It initially comes into contact. For a few thousand years, there's 10 to the minus 4 solar masses a year transferred. And now what happens? Well, now I've shrunk the system down. But the star's structure has been changing. Its mass has been continuously decreasing, and eventually the star discovers that it has a new solution. And this sort of shows what happens in the final orbital period point dwarf mass, and then it sort of marks what happens. So these numbers here are the initial mass of the companion star, 2, 3, 4, 5. Solar masses, and these solid lines are drawn for the, it's basically this, it's only drawn in this bit of parameter space where under this assumption of non-conservative transfer you can actually get through this without actually having a spiral in or making a Thorne-Dietkov object. So one thing that can happen is that you can have sort of for masses that are not too high in the initial orbital periods that are quite short, you can have so-called KSA transfer when you actually come into contact while the system is still core hydrogen burning. Then you have a rapid stage of thermal time scale transfer. You drop the companion down to a low mass, and then depending on the initial orbital period, you can then go over to something like the previous description. Okay, mate systems. And back out along the orbital periods. If you go to higher mass stars, typically they don't come into contact until you've actually, in a stable region, you don't come into contact until they've actually started helium burning, so you appear as case B. And for the extremely massive stars, there's essentially no hope of stabilizing the transfer. Now one thing to notice is that all of this little region is a nice little band, about 10 to 20 days, which looks quite promising, where five of the six systems were observed to be. And let me just perhaps say a little bit about the mass, sort of things that can happen in the mass transfer history. So I have a diagram here sort of showing some of the interesting things that can happen for lower mass systems. So this top panel is for, set of panels is for one solar mass companion stars. And this shows the rate of mass loss from the companion star. And this is the rate of mass loss from the system. And what's been done in this paper is Tarius and Savonet have assumed that you only lose mass from the system if the accretion rate is super Eddington. And here's Eddington. It's never super Eddington, so there's no mass loss from the system. Another sort of interesting thing, which is more prominent. So this panel is for 1.6 solar mass companion. thing here now with the transfer, you know, there's the super Eddington for much of the initial time, and so there's large mass loss from the system. Here, for about 40 million years, the system detaches to transfer. And if you ask about what is the fraction of this total time scale, you can ask, would we expect to see this for any of the observed X-ray binaries? And the answer is, it might be about one system, one out of 100 might be in this state. You sort of integrate over the whole population for this system, so actually 10% it's like these are shorter life systems than the other ones. And the reason for this is that as a star evolves up the red giant branch, the rate of increase of radius with time is not monotonic. And it happens when the star, as the hydrogen burning shell gets out to the region where the star, where the convection dredged down, suddenly the chemical composition changes and the star shrinks in radius briefly. And that's what this gap is. This is the star is evolving up the giant branch, the shell gets to the previous convection, to the base of the previous convection zone, there's a sudden change and the star shrinks. Now this has been in all stellar evolution calculations since 1965 or something. It's very well known, although it sort of hasn't been pointed out very strongly in the X-ray binary literature. But it would be actually quite interesting to find such a system, because such a system would be a pulsar, which had accreted some material, but not all of the material that it was going to accrete in this little gap, 40 million year gap between being an X-ray binary at this accretion rate and an X-ray binary at the lower accretion rate. And you could hope to distinguish the systems, because stars in this state are distinguishable from stars on either side by the chemical composition of their envelopes, because the shell is now into this convective region, and so the nitrogen 13 to nitrogen 14 ratio is about 100 times what it is on this side, for example. So you can actually hope to distinguish these. Frank Kerbrunt and I actually pointed out that in eccentricity in point of binaries and point dwarfs in open clusters, you could also hope to do the same kind of trick. The star will shrink and expand.
That's a helium white dwarf.
It's not a helium core. No. This is the star still has. There's.
What kind of star is it? Is it red? First ascent or is it
recent? No. It's the first descent, the radius like this. So it'll be a red giant star, which will look not very different than it did here or here, except for the nitrogen 13 ratio. So. So it'll be a pulsar to the red giant companion.
Right.
Almost filling its rough load. But not quite.
Is there any observational data on those ratios?
Of course, we've never seen such a system. We don't know any pulsars orbiting red giants.
Yeah.
And you might wonder, perhaps, is the accretion rate truly zero? Does it really turn off?
Yeah.
And there, it's a question, the red giant wall will certainly have a wind, although this is quite a small red giant, so if you use the traditional wind-luminosity relations that are used in stellar evolution, it's not obvious that the propeller, it looks to me as if the propeller of this pulsar, which has been partially spun up, would be enough to prevent accretion from the canonical wind, but there's obviously uncertainty in the canonical. There's no uncertainty in the canonical wind, but in the real wind. So the last thing I just wanted to say is that just the status of the current birth rate arguments, and some of you may remember that several years ago there was this worry that the birth rate of millisecond pulsars was 10 times the birth rate of low mass X-ray binaries. The current status is that it's about a factor of 3 difference, with I would say generously a factor of 3 uncertainties in both of them. But the calculation, I think, is not being done and cannot be done in an honest way for the reasons I've tried to convince you, that the X-ray binary sample is one extreme of the population, very low mass, short period system. So you determine the birth rate of those quite well. And then you have the pulsar birth rate. And most of the X-ray binaries can quite accurately tell you the birth rate of this region of parameter space. but it will never tell you very much about any of the birth rates in this region of parameter space, except for upper limits, and those upper limits are all easily satisfied. So the current status is that that's for orbital periods longer than about 10 days. The upper limits from the X-ray binaries are the one data point at 5 days, are easily consistent with the pulsar birth rate for these long period systems. And for these shorter period systems, there's still the pulsar birth rate, you might guess, is about a factor of 3 higher than one's best guess at the X-ray binary birth rate. But the X-ray binary birth rate is determined by taking the number of X-ray binaries and dividing by a time scale. And I showed you that that time scale is very sensitive to the initial mass. And I haven't even talked about what happens at less than 2 days orbital period, just when magnetic braking and gravitational radiation become important and shrink the orbital periods rather than expanding them. Then magnetic braking is perhaps well-defined, Frank, from one who invented it, now it doesn't exist at all, for example. My interpretation is that the birth rates of the X-ray binaries, which are the number divided by the light time, are very poorly constrained. Years, but I think this current status, one can't say if there's any argument from the birth rates that X-ray binaries do not produce millisecond pulsars.
Can I ask a more yeah. Can I say it in a much worse way? Is there any evidence that the populations are connected?
I would say 2.5 milliseconds. And
but that object, right?
And that
object orbiting a very low mass star.
That's right.
That's not what we talked about.
It's not what I talked about. There are descendants, for example, 1957 plus 20 could be a descendant of such things. And 1957 plus 20 is one third of the total birth rate of millisecond pulsars, so it's good that we found a progenitor. So the birth rate of single millisecond pulsars, which I haven't talked about, and 1957 plus 20 might be a progenitor of single millisecond pulsars, is about half of the birth rate of all of these binaries. So these low mass systems like the Poirier source and perhaps these galactic center transients that King thinks are systems, very low mass systems that evolved to the other side of the period minimum. Those systems, I think, are all quite promising as the progenitors of this half of the population that I haven't even talked about, which are the small by numbers, but they're all moving rapidly with short lifetimes, and they actually can have about half the total birth rate. For the other system, I guess I would say, perhaps the best evidence is this one Sasaki source of 5.6A X-ray binary. Clearly isn't the neutron star with a low magnetic field with an orbital period which can produce this. The other question for the other systems for which we think we might know spin periods, there is this question that perhaps the magnetic fields are much less than 10 to the 8th Gauss, the upper limits there, and then those would be progenitors of the missing pulsars rather than the observed pulsars. I agree. I think the honest answer to your question is that there is no X-ray binary which one can conclusively point to and say that it's spin period, magnetic field, and orbital period would give rise to one of these, although I think there are a few where there's a Sasaki object, we don't know the magnetic, there's no idea of the magnetic field or the spin period, so it could very well give rise to these, but you're right, for the systems that I've talked about, although not for the low mass systems, there's no single object which I can point to. It must be really looks like a progenitor element.
I was expecting you to show us a new period eccentricity curve to go through the massive systems.
It's 1:30, so.
Well, is there such a curve?
Yes, there is such a curve. Yes. Basically, in this scenario, the late evolution of these systems, the thermal time scale evolution is extremely rapid. The orbit circularizes in some complicated way.
It's not really even a curve, it's just that they're all localized at 10 days, that's what you're saying.
They're all at 10 days, but the point is that these systems, it's here, it's now, they're all at 10 days, but there's a very strong dependence on the final white dwarf mass, which determines the initial mass of these systems, and therefore the luminosity during this expanding phase. And the point is that these massive stars, I guess I didn't have time to talk about it, there's recently been determined that Cygnus X2 is a 0.5 solar mass helium star. It used to be thought to be a massive star. It was actually a 0.5 solar mass helium star. And that almost certainly is an X, I guess maybe that's a counterexample. That is a system which very likely will evolve into one of these systems, perhaps like this, like J2145 or something, the 0.5 solar mass carbon oxygen white dwarf in a several day orbital period. So that helium star will eventually begin to, it's low enough mass, it'll begin to expand and come in, it's currently probably a wind degree, but it will expand and come into rush low contact. But at a very high luminosity now, much higher than these, with much lower density envelope than for the systems, the low mass systems that I talked about. So when you try to do the same sorts of calculations, essentially the same theory, but now with very different, just now the orbital period now doesn't determine the core mass, but it's the initial mass, and one can quite easily get this range just by sort of changing initial masses from 3 solar masses to 5 solar masses.
And in that case, it's really just a calculation of the period and the eccentricity is whatever it is.
Well, it's interesting in that it's actually what you predict in this case, and unfortunately we don't actually know any of these masses well,
yeah.
But what you predict is the relationship between the eccentricity and the core and the mass of the white dwarf. Mm-hmm. So this diagram is no longer informative in this direction, yeah. In this plane, but if you had a white dwarf mass in this direction was accurately determined.
Right, I see.
These systems with the higher eccentricities you have to produce from the much higher luminosity initial mass, and there should be systematically higher white dwarf masses, although the relationship is not extremely tight because there's also a dependence on the initial orbital period. But there should be a correlation. And unfortunately, none of these systems can have any relativistic information, so the masses are between 0.4 and 2 solar masses or something. So. It's something I would do statistics. So
let's thank Sterl.